Hello and welcome to the penultimate Albion Roar of the season here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at RadioReverb.com, on DAB and of course on our podcast. I'm Ailey Packham and we are breathing a sigh of relief in association with oldfootballshirts.com. Well, with our friends from Croydon calling time on Cardiff's top flight stay on Saturday, we went into Sunday's clash at Arsenal already knowing we would be returning to the Emirates in league action next season. However, the flip-flops and sombreros will have to wait, as the eyes of the world will be on the Amex this Sunday as the title race goes to the final day with our visitors, Manchester City, in the box seat. But you knew that, right? On today's show, Alan Wares and I will look back on last week's game at Arsenal. We'll also be joined by David Mooney from Man City's Blue Moon podcast, and we'll also catch up with Albion Deputy Chairman Paul Barber. Alan, it's been, been a week.
Few is the word of the week. It's, I made a point of avoiding all the shenanigans of Saturday, so I'm sure everyone else was having their adrenaline turning brown, you know, throughout the game. I think Palace got an early goal, which really, really helped anyway. But, it was kind of, you know, exciting. Yeah, Cardiff got their second goal in the 90, whatever it was, minute. But, Palace did us a favour. And I'm sure that, it'll be talked about many times. I mean, we mentioned on the show last week that, Palace fans wanted us to stay up. And, I think in that sense, everyone's happy. I particularly enjoy Gary Chivers' tweet. If there's nothing like a 28-year grudge to really set the pulses racing.
About Neil,
did you read it?
I did see it, yeah.
It was basically, for those who missed it, he said, never like Neil Warnock, especially after the 1991 playoff final, don't like him, horrible man, glad Cardiff are relegated, or words to that effect. He might have dropped in the odd bit of Anglo-Saxon, I can't remember. But
no, he didn't.
No, but if anyone, you can just hear it in his voice, can't you? And no, a nice 28-year grudge has just resurfaced. Yeah. But you, Chiv.
But at the other end, Al, this title race has been quite something. I mean,
good to have a title race.
One team is going to end up with 95 plus points and not win the title. That's incredible.
It is pretty incredible. But it also shows that, you know, all right, last season Man City had it won by, you know, December or whatever it was. And at least we've got the excitement of this going to the last day. But it also shows the widening of the gap between, you know, the top and the bottom. You know, we talk about the top six, and sometimes those top six actually do take their time to get into gear and get their place. And it might be sort of mid-October before all six are finally in place. But you look at the top of the table and we've got 90-plus points for two teams. But you also look at the bottom of the table and Huddersfield could hardly buy a win. And Fulham only started playing well when
once
they brought
Scott,
in
Scott Parker.
Well, exactly. When they started playing well, they took points off us. Yeah, quite. But
I mean, out of the relegated side, I mean, obviously we did the double over Huddersfield. Mm-hmm. But I mean, Cardiff took 4 points off us, and Cardiff took 6 points off us.
Yeah, Fulham took 4 points off us. Cardiff took six. It's kind of a weird thing. I mean, we did very well up at Huddersfield, and let's face it, we're all expecting a defeat. At a time of the season where we weren't overly worried, we were nicely clear, mid-table, blah, blah, blah. But we did the business, and it helped that Meunier got sent off, and Bissouma turned up properly for the first time, and that was excellent. So at the time, it was thought, oh, great, you know, and Huddersfield were relegation fodder at the time. The Cardiff game was a farce, especially the last minute. Mm. The referee had a meltdown. But then I think, you know, as we've said on the show already, everything just sort of like went south after New Year. Yes, the cup run could have actually had a say in, you know, a big influence in that. But that really shouldn't influence how the rest of the team play in any given game. We've made it. We're safe. The first half of the season is, you know, the preparation for was preparation for the rest of the season. We got our points on the board first. But, you know, we're all going to be looking next season. We're talking about this next week's show. We're all looking for improvement throughout the summer. And hopefully Paul Barber can actually sort of enlighten us on that.
Yes, he will. Yes, he will. But, okay, another a plus point for us, Al, is we actually went to a top six side this weekend. And we actually got our first point away from home against them. Now, it's been a long time coming. And we nearly hung out against Spurs. Our performances up at Old Trafford have been decent, and we've possibly certainly deserved something there last year, maybe again this year.
It's been a while coming, the first point against a top six side away again, from
home. We nearly took something off Liverpool first away game of the season.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you look at that game that was they scored by, you know, just one tiny slip. Manchester United, we played. That was the first time we really played well up there. City, even City, we made a decent account of ourselves. I mean, obviously they were on the beach at the time, but you know, do you remember who scored the goal up there last season?
It was Leo Ajoa.
It was, yeah. So that's going back quite a way. So
it does seem like a long time.
It does seem like a long time ago. I certainly think that we've warranted a point, at least. I don't think three just yet, but we've certainly warranted a point in some of our performances in those games against the top six. But, I mean, you look back on, we'll talk about it in depth in a minute, but, you know, look back on that and you think, well, actually, for all the fact that, you know, Arsenal had plenty of chances, we could have actually swiped all three.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's look at the team then that day. We had, obviously, Matt Ryan in goal. The oldest swinger in town, Bruno, kept his place.
Yeah.
And deservedly. And with...
Is Montoya even making the bench these days?
He wasn't on the bench. No.
I mean, that's because he's only got
one position. So, I mean...
You reckon that... Bong can come up. Bong, I've never seen play. Oh, I actually tell a lie. I've seen Bernardo play at right back, and I saw him do that against.
Bong
Watford
can play left and right.
Yeah, so can Bernardo. Well, I say so can Bernardo, but
so can Montoya actually.
Not quite. So
but yeah, we're moving. Yeah. On. But I mean, Bruno, he's the voice of reason. He's a calmness in that defence.
He's more than calmness. He is the leader. He's skillful. He's still got it. You know, he's got the mind and pace and skill still. I mean, he does show no signs of letting up. Whether he feels like quitting just yet, we don't know. We'll consider that again later in the show. But, you know, whether, you know, he's going to, you know, he shows no sign of letting up. And he's looking great.
Okay. Well, okay. And also we had Jahan Bashkot in the team ahead of Knockhart in this one. We saw a return to the starting lineup for Solly March. Obviously, Glenn Murray up front as well.
Solly is finishing the season very, very well.
Yeah, he's showing the player he is.
He's showing the player he can be. I still think even then, as well as he's playing now, I still think there's more to come from him. I mean, you hear about the players at training, they're talking about how Solly March can play. And even then, I mean, don't get me wrong, he was fantastic when he came on against Newcastle. And the fear is that, okay, they were brilliant when they came on as a sub, and then when you start them, they don't have the same impact. Well, I think he actually had a very good impact throughout that game.
Okay, but the game didn't actually start...
I'll just quickly say, the less said about Ali J, the better.
Okay, but the game didn't start that well for us, and I mean, you can never trust a player who's named after a bowl of crisps, can you?
Not as such, no. How, are we talking about Walkers here?
boom tish. No, Nacho Monreal.
No, let's... not good. No, it's... no, I mean, that. How can we call that penalty? Bent.
And if
anyone's upset by that, let them sue. That penalty was ridiculous. Anthony Taylor was looking straight at it. And incidentally, I'll mention about Walker here. It's the same referee who didn't send off Kyle Walker.
We are aware of this.
Yeah. he looked straight at it. He could see. I mean, all right, we have the benefit of the slow motion replays in hindsight. And we saw it on the screen in our press box area. And I wasn't 100% sure. You could argue that Ali J wasn't in the right position to start with. But that in itself doesn't warrant a penalty. You know, so it's... he clearly got the ball. He didn't touch the fella. It was a dive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is a debate for another day, Al. But I mean, VAR comes in, and now we have survived. We will definitely be having VAR next year. So, I mean, we'll actually see.
Let's look at this particular incident, and how VAR is going to be applied. And this is what the concern is.
Clear and obvious error.
That's the point. Was it a clear and obvious error? Now, if it's kind of as the cricket equivalent is the umpire's call. So you have to look at it, and you've got to have another referee who we thought was going to say, hey, Mr. Taylor, you might not have another look at this, but he's not. He's actually going to have the possibility of overruling him.
I still think they're going to have the on-screen. So
I hope they do, but we are told that they are not. So we'll see what happens in the meantime, and they might change their minds. But the point is that it's all, again, down to an opinion. He touched him first. You know, the whole nonsense of there was contact. And what constitutes a foul, and sometimes we don't necessarily appreciate what constitutes a foul and what constitutes a red card offence and so on. So I'm really not sure that VAR would have necessarily, and also, as we know, the whole notion of culpability for a foul is much you know, higher for a top six side than it is for the rest of us.
Okay, well, Aubameyang did step up and he gave the Gunners
the lead. How did he finish it?
With aplomb.
With aplomb.
And he gave the Gunners the lead there. And there was a succession of other chances at which they created, some from distance, some not from not so far out. But Matty Ryan.
Distance, when you say from a distance, are you talking about the distance they were shot from or the distance they missed the goal?
Well, Matty Ryan was called on time and time again, he was magnificent.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't get me wrong, some of the Arsenal shots did end up way into the crowd, and the people in Rose Ed were nervous. But yeah, he was on fire. Matty Ryan, you know, and we're going to have this debate next week as to who the player of the season is. Don't get me wrong, I have no problem with Shane Duffy, but mine was Matty Ryan. And in that,
even though he was missing for half the season.
Well, he was missing for a month.
That's long enough.
Well, he was missing for three or four games, which is incidentally about the same amount of time that Shane Duffy was missing after getting sent off against Palace. So let's face it, for us, as much as Duffy and Dunk were lauded for their blocks, sorry, Matty Ryan was the one that kept us in the game by a distance.
Absolutely, but we actually got our mojo back in this game. We actually played with a lot more attacking intent than we had done. It looked like they were a lot more relaxed.
They played without fear. You could see the fear against Cardiff and against Bournemouth and against Southampton. You could, you know, that everyone was just, you know, horribly getting it wrong, terrified of making a mistake, terrified almost of passing it forward and someone else being out of position. So you've got to have the, you know, and we saw it when they had the second half against Newcastle. They just said, you know, all right, we'd still be up anyway if, you know, whatever we'd have done against Newcastle, whatever we'd have done against Arsenal. But we were so good in the second half against Newcastle. It's like, we said it before, a switch had been flicked on. And, you know, obviously you can't play the same way against Arsenal, but they were, you know, so much better.
Now, I mean, obviously social media is a crazy
place.
Are you
about to talk about Arsenal TV by any chance?
No, I'm not. I'm actually going to talk about, there was some, I mean, we're giving fantastic mentions here to Sonny March, who was great, but Yves Bissouma at times of that game was absolutely genius. Now, there's the thing at the end where he was actually looked like he was laughing at the Arsenal player, which he wasn't. He was actually walking towards Gaëtan Bong, but that's another thing. But but there's one in the first half where basically he kept the ball and the Arsenal players couldn't get the ball with him. He was on his knees at one point, and someone set this to the circus theme music.
I was about to say it was something more like out of the Harlem Globetrotters.
It was like it was absolutely genius. You check it out.
But what we've also got is an idea of how, you know, he's still a raw talent. I mean, we've seen him carry the ball, and he's the fellow who'll take us forward 30 or 40 yards. Now, if only the rest of the team would therefore catch up with him, and sometimes he'll run into that blind alley. I mean, it's Knockhart will do it, but he'll try and take on two or three fellas. What Bissouma will do is just sort of like, you know, he'll run across the pitch trying to bring players in.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes his second touch is a tackle. That's the
worry. I think that's improved. I don't recall him doing that against Arsenal.
No, he was fine against Arsenal, but he was great.
Absolutely, and he kept the ball alive. He kept going. It's not as though he was going for the magic, but he was genuinely looking for the moment, for that half yard of space, for the pass.
But I mean, in that move where he kept the move alive and kept the ball moving,
skidding on the floor.
He was just genius. But I mean, a chance was created for Glenn Murray, who
now we disagree on this. You think it was a sitter.
I think he should have done better with that. Yeah,
I think that's harsh. It was slightly behind him, and it wasn't played in with a lot of power.
But so that sort of thing's bread and butter for Glenn.
Not when you have to crane your neck and basically almost have to rip your head off in order to get the what you want.
How many times have you seen him score from that position before with exactly
well,
the
let's
same
face it, how many times
ball?
Has he had the opportunity lately? So,
well, yeah,
it's been a
practice,
while.
I'll give you that.
Well, yeah. I mean, he's probably got dust on the back of his neck now. So, it's...
Yeah, his hair's grown back and everything.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it was on target, and we've seen the keeper made, you know, when we played West Ham last year, he did exactly the same, and it went under the keeper's body. So, you know, if you get it on target, you've got a chance. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, I think you're being harsh by saying he should have done better. Okay. He could have done better. He could have scored.
Okay. But, I mean, Arsenal carried on having a success of chances. Matty Ryan was equal to it. We got ourselves to half-time, and we also got ourselves back into the game, and it was a magnificent run from Sonny March from inside his own half, and Jacka can't quite clearly
the Swiss Lee Catamol, as they refer to him on the Arsenal social media. Yeah, I mean, it was the faintest of clips. I was never 100% sure, and you realise it was actually his knee that caught Solly. I was trying to work out where the contact was. But yeah, he clearly calls him. The fact that he didn't protest, I think, says more than anything. The Arsenal fans were sort of like throwing their hands up in the air, sort of typical.
They moan
kind of
a lot, don't they?
I think they've got a lot to moan about. But, you know, the expectations up there are ludicrous. But they weren't, well, from our point of view, they weren't poor. They were clearly the better side. But it's just because it's the nature of the expectations. I mean, for our point of view, you know, we drew 1-1. We were the second best side. We're delighted. They drew 1-1. They were the better side. They got the ump. You know,
indeed.
That's football, isn't it?
Okay. But Glenn stepped up and he scored our first goal away from home since Anthony Knockarts at Crystal Palace on March the 9th.
Yeah, so, well, they all count. It's another one to the total. He's got another year left with us. So, you know, will he get to Tommy Cook's record? Who knows? Yeah.
But, I mean, again, Arsenal had more chances. Matty Ryan was equal to it. They missed some sitters. But then so did we. Now,
everyone's doing their pieces over last bit of action.
Well, let's just talk about the first lead, the great ball across to Anthony Knockhart. Knockhart's control of that ball.
Very good.
His ball into the box. Solly March with
a diving header.
The
cameras for that one, if that had gone in.
No, that was... That's
Andy Gray-esque, wasn't it?
Oh, it was Keith Hutchin.
It was all over. I mean, a keeper made a decent save. It's just Gross's follow-up, which ended up further away from the goal from when he started. But, you know, he was just obviously hit it with the wrong foot. And, you know, but yes, it was great stuff. I mean, you know, we had the commentators next to us saying that was a sitter. And then they realised, oh, no, actually, it probably wasn't that, you know. So it was an open goal, but, you know, it really wasn't. But
the commentators next to us were completely mental.
They were.
But it was great. But, I mean, overall, I mean, we're absolutely delighted to get the point now.
Yeah, but, you know, that last bit of action, you know, where we could have got all three, and only look up. You could see, because it was right in front of us.
Yeah. I wasn't going to mention that.
No, but, you know.
Because Match of the Day didn't either. But
that's bizarre, isn't it? But, I mean, we could see it. Even the BBC on their text commentary said, you know, Andoni is through. If he could just see March, and they just scream in capital letters, pass it, man. Mm. Yeah. But you know full well that, you know, it's just the nature of how it is at Brighton Hove Albion. We'd have missed it anyway. Yeah.
Okay, let's move on then. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. We're delighted to be brought to you in association with the fantastic oldfootballshirts.com. Over 100,000 shirts there, and there's some absolute mingers, there's some beauties, there's some classics. This isn't one of them. Alan, if you could just describe that for me.
I certainly can. It's green, with a broad white stripe down the left-hand side. It's made by Nike, sponsored by Clonakilty Sausages, who doesn't like a sausage on their shirt. I'm going to try and read the badge.
I mean, just
it just says Football Club.
Well, I'll tell you just to give it a better description, actually.
It's basically our orange shirt with the black stripe,
that's
but
exactly
instead of green and white instead.
It's a Nike
guess would
off
be,
the peg.
Yes.
That sort of thing that Phil hates.
Yes. So my guess is that Clonakilty is an Irish Irish sausages.
Is,
so
yes.
And in green, who knew? So I couldn't pick the club, so I'm just going to say an Irish club, which you've already said yes to.
Oh, yes, it is. And here is your shirt of the week. It's chosen for no apparent reason, and this is the 2015 home shirt of Cork City, sponsored by the fabulous Clonakilty, who make very fine black and white pudding. So there you go. The side was formed in 1984 after the demise of Cork United, and former Chelsea and Crystal Palace, that's the way that Phil has spelt it here, striker Bobby Tambling was the club's first ever manager. Now, who knows where Bobby Tambling was born?
I do, actually. He was born in Storrington.
Yes, he was. Often known as the Rebel Army, or simply just City, they play at the 7,484 capacity Turner's Cross Stadium, which is owned by the governing body of soccer in the southwest region of Ireland, the Munster FA. Irish football suffers a bit, with most football supporters are dyed-in-the-wool Liverpool, Man City, Celtic, etc. fans, and rarely watch their local teams. Crowds in the League of Ireland Premier Division average around 2,500. However, Cork manage a respectable 5,000 plus for most of their home games. That said, Cork have made it into European competitions on 19 occasions, entertaining the likes of Bayern Munich, Galatasaray and Red Star Belgrade, amongst others. Domestically, they've won the league three times, the cup in various guises more than 10 times. The club is owned by a supporters trust, the Friends of the Rebel Army Society, and the trust was originally set up as just that, a trust. But the after the financial collapse of the club in 2008, the trust took over ownership and control of the team. They were able to raise enough money to regain a licence from the FAI and enter the side into the First Division. And in 2011, they won promotion back to the Premier League. Only one real link to the Albion, and that is, of course, James Tilley is on loan there at the moment. And the Billingshurst-born striker is currently on loan from the Albion and has made 12 appearances in the side, scoring once so far. So thanks for that, Phil.
Fabulous. Thanks for that, Phil.
Now, with us securing our Premier League survival, or with the help of our friends from up the road, I caught up with Albion Deputy Chairman Paul Barber to discuss the future and what next season may bring. Well, hi, Paul, firstly, and thanks for joining us again. And the last time you joined us was on the eve of a game against Manchester City. And here we are, on the eve of a game against Manchester City.
Yeah, it's a shame we haven't played them so many times this season, isn't it? But no, we're very much looking forward to the game. And obviously, you know, being in a position where our Premier League future is secure for next season, it should be a great atmosphere.
OK. Well, with the curtain about to come down on this season, how have you viewed it as a whole?
Well, our primary objective at the start of the season was to stay in the Premier League and to build on what we created from last season, to progress further in the Cups if we could. So in terms of those two objectives, you know, we've achieved both of them. We also wanted to try and build on the position and improve on the position from last year, so 15th or better. Obviously, that hasn't happened. But overall, I think we can say that, you know, surviving a second season in the Premier League has been a success. But we know that the last, you know, few months have been very difficult and, you know, not the most enjoyable for anyone at the club, fans or staff or players or coaches. So, you know, we're very aware of that and looking forward to building on what we've created again next season.
I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, the remit before a ball was kicked would have been to stay up anyway. So, I mean, can survival and reaching a cup semi be regarded as a success?
Well, I think, again, if you put it into context, you know, we've only had six seasons in the top flight in our entire 118-year history. Mm. You know, this is still a very, very new level of football for our club to be playing at. And particularly in the Premier League era where, you know, the game has changed hugely from the last time that we had four seasons at the top level. So I think it can. But I also think there's, you know, room for improvement. We know that. You learn every season in football, no matter what division you're in. And, you know, the same is true this season as well.
Yeah. Well, when we spoke last time, we were talking about planning for next season and where we were at that particular moment in time. We weren't sure what division that was going to be. Now, obviously, we know that now. So, I mean, the planning can continue at full speed ahead now.
Yeah, the planning never stops, AD. I mean, we're working all the time on potential targets. We're working out, you know, what the opportunities might be to strengthen the squad, strengthen the starting 11. All those things, you know, go on literally round the clock all year round. And it just simply makes it a lot easier and a lot clearer, you know, as soon as you know which division you're going to be in, because it means you can narrow those targets a little bit further. And you don't have to worry about, you know, plan B for at least another year, which is obviously what we would prefer every year. But we're well advanced with that. Obviously, Dan Ashworth has been on board now for a little while. He's very acquainted with, you know, the way we work and the key people that work on the transfer windows. And obviously, he's going to be a very important part of that process as we go forward.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's been working with Paul Winstanley and he's been working with John Morling as well. Obviously, he's had a chance to take in the place now and have a look around, see how it works. What improvements can we make? I mean, I guess we're not going to see anything overnight there.
No, I think most people would say that, you know, you need a succession of transfer windows to make dramatic improvements. We don't feel we need to make dramatic improvements. So we would hope to make incremental improvements each window that goes by. You know, some players will be more available at certain times of year than others. And you know, again, we know, you know, from all the work we've been doing during the year, which players are more attainable during the summer. So all of that gets factored into the process. And I think, as Dan will be the first to tell you, we've still got a very young academy as well. Young in the sense that, we've only been a Category 1 academy now for four seasons. It's still very, very, very early stages in terms of developing, a football philosophy and bringing players through to the first team. And there are many other clubs who've had academies for many, many, many more years than we have and are still not bringing through players as quickly as they would like. So it's a long-term process and there's going to be a lot of learning along the way, as there is with all the teams, whether it's the men's first team or the women's first team. We're operating an era where the club is literally competing at the highest level of domestic football that it can in all of its areas. And it's a long time, if ever, that we've been able to say that.
Yeah, I mean, I think from a fan's perspective, you look at it and you see, the last players that actually made it through to the first team was Sully March and Lewis Dunk, and they seem to have been around for a long time. And I mean, we talk about pathway and we're looking at some really exciting talents that we've got coming through there, and I think we'd like to see some of those coming through. But I mean, obviously when you're in a relegation dogfight, which we ended up in, you can't necessarily blood those players, can you?
No, it's difficult because the manager's job is to try and get results here and now. And, when times are tough and results are not going for you, you want your most experienced players to be on the pitch, assuming they're fit and in form. And, you can't blame any manager of any club for doing that in the situation we've been in the last couple of months. But also, when you're investing £4 to £5 million a year in an academy, you do want young players to come through. And Dan Ashworth has got a great track record of encouraging coaches at all levels of international football, as well as in his previous role in club football, to do just that. And it's about getting the balance right. It's about getting the timing right, because it's all very easy for the supporters and for those of us that sit in suits to push young players on coaches and say they must be ready for the first team. Been in our academy for years, but if they're not ready, you can do more long-term harm than good by pushing them forward too quickly. And part of the loan program, part of the great work that David Weir is doing, again working with Dan and working with John Morling, is picking the right loan opportunities for some young players, some of the players that we've invested in, and giving them the experience they need to make that step up to the Premier League. And again, this is a very, very different level of football to what we've been playing in the past. And, getting those decisions wrong could be damaging to those players' long-term prospects. So it's important to get it right and important we take the time that they need.
I mean, there's been some questions asked about some of the recruitment that has gone on over the last season, and where, any transfer is a gamble to a certain extent. You don't know whether it's going to be a hit or miss. But a lot of the players came in and they weren't necessarily box fresh. They weren't ready to go. They were injured. Is there plans to look at maybe more experienced players who are ready to go?
Well, again, I can remember looking back at my emails and Twitter and various other forms of social media at the start of last season, congratulating the club on what a wonderful window it had just had. Good players don't become bad players overnight. Some players take longer to adjust to life in a new country and a new club, and there's a whole range of factors that go into that. And sometimes players will develop injuries towards the end of a season when you've already sort of targeted them, and others will pick up injuries in the early part of pre-season, which you can't do much about. So, I think we have to make sure that we give all of the players that we bring into the club plenty of time to adjust. And in some cases, that adjustment will be quicker than others and sometimes easier than others. But we've got to be patient. And, as I say, good players that have been scouted and looked at over a very long period of time don't become bad players over a course of the season or even half a season. We've just got to be patient. Mm.
Now, obviously, again, in regards to recruitment, are we going to be in a position to be more flexible with our wage structure now we've had 3 years of the Sky TV money?
Well, again, wage structures are what they are for a reason. And, we look at our wage structures in terms of the overall financial position of the club. One thing that's not going to happen next year is there being a massive increase in the revenues that we receive. So, again, to massively push our cost structure up doesn't make any sense for the long-term viability of the club. Where we have to be smart is where we can recruit at the right values, obviously in the right positions. And yes, the Premier League revenues give us the opportunity to compete at a level that we've never competed at before. we've still got to be prudent. We've still got to think of the long-term sustainability of the club and make sure that we cut our cloth accordingly.
Yeah. Now, obviously, a lot's been said about the fact that yourself and the other members of the board are going away for a couple of days, which you do at the end of every season to plan and put together your vision for the next season. Now, most people thought that was you and Martin Perry sitting in a beach bar doing Jaeger bombs, but obviously that's not quite the case. You know, comparing mustard jumpers is probably your thing. But, I mean, there has been talk about this vision and what's reasonable and aspirational. So talk us through that. I mean, what do you think is going to be reasonable and aspirational?
Well, I think over the last sort of half a decade or so, you know, getting ourselves ready to play in the Premier League as a Category 1 academy and as a potential Women's Super League team, which we now are, has been a really good and exciting and aspirational vision for everyone, both inside the club and outside the club. And as I said in the interview earlier this week, I don't think, you know, staying in the Premier League is particularly aspirational for fans. It's very important to people inside the club because it drives so much of the work that we do and funds so much of the work that we do. But totally except on the outside, that it's not the most exciting vision. You know, it's not for me to determine that vision. It's for me to sort of inform the board of what I think is achievable, what I think is reasonable, what I think is aspirational and exciting, but at the same time, not setting us up for a fall.
Yeah.
And I think we've got to be reasonable and we've got to be practical. You know, we are a club that is still learning to compete at this level, a club that's still adjusting to, you know, a very, very different level of football to what it's been used to for most of its history. Mm. It's going to take time to establish ourselves at this level. There's going to be some bumps along the way. You know, God forbid, we may even have to go down to try and come back up again at some point in the future. Tony and I have always been very clear about that. And we've only got to look at some of the clubs that have been relegated in, you know, in the last few seasons to see that that's possible for clubs that would probably consider themselves to be very established as Premier League clubs. So, you know, it is the toughest league in the world. It's a brutal league, you know, and if you just simply drop your performance levels by just a fraction of 1% or worse, a couple of 1%, then you really are in real trouble in this league because the quality is so significant and it's relentless. And, you know, week in, week out, you're playing teams that are capable of beating you on their day. Mm. And also, on top of that, as we'll see on Sunday, you come up against some of the best players in the entire world. So, you know, we shouldn't underestimate, you know, how difficult it is to compete at this level. And we shouldn't actually be too harsh of judges on the season we've just had, because to survive a second season in the Premier League is very, very difficult. And we've achieved that. And now we can move on and hopefully improve again for next season.
But when you're using words like aspirational, though, that generally means progress. I mean, what would you consider to be progress next season?
Well, I think from our position of finishing 15th last season, we genuinely wanted to build on that and ideally improve on that. We didn't. You know, we did get safe a couple of hours earlier than we did last season, but we're probably going to finish with, you know, we are going to finish with less points this season. So is that a backward step? Yes, you consider that. Did we have high spots along the way? Yep, beating Palace, beating Manchester United, you know, taking points off of Arsenal in both games, getting to an FA Cup semi-final. All those things, I think, show a club that, you know, that has made progress again. And staying in the Premier Division for a second season is, I think, you know, solid progress. But we want to be better. We want to keep moving forward from there. You know, we don't want to have the last sort of couple of months all over again, because it's, you know, it's painful for everybody and disconcerting for everyone. But it's wrong for me, and would be wrong for me, to start setting targets now. I think, as always, we're going to look to progress. And, you know, we want to improve where we finished in the Women's Super League. We would love to have another season in the under-23s Premier League 2 like we had this season, and maybe go one or two places better again. We want to continue to compete in the academy. We want to bring young players through to the first team. You know, we want to continue to improve our stadium facilities and our training ground facilities. All of those things are measures of progress. for a club of our size. And, you know, I think we should look forward to that and be excited about that.
And again, another measure of progress from this season you could look at is, of course, Lewis Dunk getting his first international cap, which was tremendous for him and for the club, of course. Now, with players like Lewis, he has progressed in this league, as has Shane Duffy, as has Sonny March and a few others. They'll certainly have raised people's interest in them. So it's going to be quite hard to hang on to some of those during the summer, will it?
It's always going to be tough to hold on to your best players when there are bigger clubs with bigger budgets. But, you know, we always start from a position of maintaining and moving forward is about keeping hold of your best players and adding to that squad, adding to that starting 11 and improving it wherever you can. So, you know, we're certainly in no mood and have no need whatsoever to sell any of our players. You know, we've got a great group, really, really talented group. We've got great character. And I think we've seen in the last few games when the pressure was really on, the spirit and the determination to grind out results where we can. And I think, you know, the players again deserve a lot of credit for, you know, keeping their composure under enormous pressure when things really weren't going well for them, and coming away from big games, important games with crucial points. And, you know, in the end, you know, who'd have thought that it would be Crystal Palace that would be the team that did us the biggest favour of all by beating Cardiff? But that's football. And, you know, we took 6 points off of Palace this year. Cardiff took 6 points off of us. You know, the margins in this league are thin. You know, yeah, they are very, very thin.
I'm so pleased you brought that up. It was the fact that Palace... Did we beat Palace? Oh, yeah, of course we did. I mean, we were talking to a lot of their supporters at the Robert Eaton Memorial Fund game this season a couple of weeks ago, which we won as well, incidentally. And obviously, the Renf game is something which you've always been involved with as well over the years. But we were talking to a lot of their supporters and they didn't want us to go down. They want a chance to get revenge next season.
Of course. And, I don't know too many supporters of any club that really want their bitterest rivals to be relegated because, you know, the games, you know, the two games each year, and in our case, usually we get them in the cup as well, so it's usually three games each year, you know, are amongst the most looked forward to. And, you know, most clubs want their rivals, you know, in their division as much as they might enjoy the sort of the relegation for the short term. Actually, playing against them is really what it's all about. So I'm sure Palace fans will be delighted we're still up, as our fans will be delighted still to be up and playing Palace. So we look forward to those games again next year.
Okay. Well, there's been a couple of other big games this season as well. Obviously, there was the FA Cup semi-final, which was a great adventure for all of us, really, and probably a learning curve. I mean, did you think it ultimately hurt us in the long run?
I don't actually think so. I think, you know, again, if you're struggling in the league and you're getting wins in the cup, then that's helping morale. In the case of some squad rotation, it's giving players that you want to try and keep fit and interested the games that they need. You know, players might emerge in a cup run that gives the manager options in the league and so on and so forth. So I don't think so. And I think, again, you know, for the second season in the Premier League, we've maintained some, you know, high levels of fitness amongst the squad as a whole. Obviously, we've had one or two injuries. You're always going to get that in any league, in any squad at any time. But, you know, we've been fortunate. And, you know, I think the cup run has helped us give all of those players games that they needed. And obviously, the day out at Wembley, the result we wanted, of course it wasn't. But again, we were playing, you know, one of the best teams in the world. And, you know, I felt, and I think we all felt, that the team on that day acquitted themselves very well, stayed in the game, you know, for the whole of the time, despite going behind early. And 35,000 Albion fans had a great day out despite the result. And
yeah, it was
again,
great.
You know, helped put our club on the map. You know, this game on Sunday is probably going to be the biggest live TV audience for an Albion game in history. Again, it's another opportunity for our club to show, you know, what we're capable of in a stadium that, you know, is admired across the football world. And again, I'm sure our fans will respond in kind and, you know, create the kind of atmosphere that that Liverpool fans will be hoping we can create to give ourselves that.
Well,
little
like
bit
they
of an
did, like they did against Barcelona.
Incredible! What a great night that was.
That's a football
what an
story.
Amazing! What an amazing response from the fans. I mean that was just amazing.
Like when we're not doing the Albion Roar, we're doing quite a lot of other media stuff nationwide, and the narrative there is they're not giving us a hope in hell, and they're saying that City have already won the title. But hang on a minute, this is football. This is theatre. It's not been written yet, and I think we can upset the apple cart here.
Well, anything can happen. And I think, you know, very few people on the run we were having expected us to get a point at Wolves. Very few people expected us to take Tottenham to the last couple of minutes of the game in their new stadium. Very few people expected us to get a point at Arsenal. And as you say, very, very few people would have expected Liverpool to beat Barcelona by four goals last night.
It was 50 to 1.
Without the two best strikers. So, you know, football is an incredible sport and it's full of unexpected moments and unexpected situations. And, you know, whatever happens, you know, even the best players in the world in any given game can underperform or freeze or, you know, just simply not reach the levels that they would be expected to. And I think we saw that last night with Barcelona. And there's no reason why we can't see it again. But we know it's going to be difficult. I mean, as I said, we're playing some just fantastic players with a world-class coach and an incredible team. It's going to be very difficult. But we're at home. The pressure is off us. It's on them. And let's hope that we can really put on a show for our fans and also the people that are watching from around the world. Yeah. It'd be a great occasion.
I mean, obviously not from an Albion perspective, but I mean, like you just said, from a worldwide one, the game on Sunday is probably the biggest it's been held at the Amex, really, isn't it? Really?
Well, without any doubt whatsoever. And you know, people all over the world will be tuning in because I think most people will expect Liverpool to beat Wolves. They won't necessarily be expecting us to beat City, but they know that it's going to take that, or at least a draw from us, for Liverpool to sneak over the line. And therefore, I think the attention is on our game. It's just wonderful to have that opportunity to show the world that, you know, that we've got an amazing stadium, great fans, and you know, our team is going to give it their best shot, and I'm sure they will.
I mean, obviously, we've got to talk about the other side of this as well. I mean, there is talk of maybe a few City fans turning up without tickets. Now, obviously, the open ground policy at the end of the game, which we all love, is a thing. I mean, presumably that will carry on, even if there's a load of City fans, waiting to get in outside.
Yeah, you know, we always do risk assessments for every game, and we'll sort of look at the circumstances we're facing on the day. And you know, we've been saying for some time now that, you know, it would be very silly for Albion fans to sell their tickets to anyone who might be a City fan or people they don't know. We've caught a few this week doing that, and that's stupid because that means they get a ban and the person who's bought that ticket won't be coming into the ground. But we also know that, you know, there's a huge demand for the game, and the season ticket exchange has been active for some time. It's working really well. There's hundreds of tickets being exchanged. We know we're going to have a full house. But if there are people there without tickets on the day or they're looking for ticket touts, then, you know, they will be moved on and they will be moved away from the ground. You know, we're certainly not going to take any risks with, you know, our usual match day policies. So hopefully people will be sensible. It is live on TV. They haven't got to worry about not being able to see the game, which has been one of the problems in the past. And of course, is one of the big advantages of live TV coverage. It does mean a large number of people can see the game that wouldn't otherwise be able to. But we're hoping for a great atmosphere. And, you know, we haven't got any problems with Manchester City fans turning up and enjoying themselves. And obviously, if they are successful on the day, you know, our club will be the first to congratulate them. And they will receive their trophy after the game, after our lap of appreciation from the players and the fans.
They could always do it on the bandstand, but you might have to put a roof on it first.
We can't afford a roof,
eh? It's with Dean all over again.
it's got that sort of a little bit of reminiscence of people. Yeah, they can think back to the past.
Okay, I mean, it's just a couple of other things. I mean, there's new plans afoot with Seagulls TV. What can you tell us about that?
Well, there's a lot of work going on behind the scenes to relaunch our website. You know, it's taken a big decision to come out of the pro forma contract that we were in for such a long time and you know, made economic sense for the club. But we've taken the big decision to invest in our own facility. Not in a position to talk, you know, specifically about all the things that are coming with that. But it's exciting and you know, it's being built by the team internally. We've done a lot of testing on colours and fonts and styles and functionality and all those sorts of things. And, you know, we're excited about that. Inevitably, when anything new comes in, there's going to be time, you know, it's going to take some time for it to bed in, and no doubt there'll be teething problems. But we're trying to make sure we iron out those as far as possible before the launch. And we're looking forward to seeing people's reaction to it.
Okay. And just finally, Paul, you've just been out in Madrid. What can you tell us about Andrea Agnelli's plans? And he's the Juventus chairman, incidentally, and leader of the Euro Club Association. And how does that affect us?
Well, it potentially affects us in quite significantly because, you know, the plans are to effectively create three European competitions, Champions League, which would effectively become a closed shop for 24 of the 32 competing clubs, and then two separate European competitions, Europa League 1 and 2, which will actually then feed the Champions League. And so, you know, the big concern is in order to facilitate all of these extra European games, it will take away weekend football from domestic leagues, not just in the UK or England, but across Europe, which, you know, we are, as a Premier League, fundamentally opposed to. Fans groups are opposed to it, and two fans groups were invited to attend the meeting this week in Madrid and spoke very well as to why they are opposed to it, and we're 100% in agreement with them. We don't think this is good for domestic football. We don't think it is good for clubs of our size. Financially, it could impede the ability of domestic leagues to raise the money they currently do from TV rights and sponsorship and so on. And for fans, you know, the logistical challenges of not just having to watch their team play in Europe at weekends, but the additional burden of midweek travel for fans to play, to watch domestic matches be played, it's just totally unacceptable. And you know, I was there in Madrid this weekend, or this past couple of days rather, speaking as the Premier League spokesman on this issue, and, you know, made our point, which we think this is a bad idea. We don't support it. And, you know, I was pleased to report that the Premier League unanimously is against the idea, and that includes the big four, five, six clubs as well. So we await now the next move, and that is really for the European leagues, which is an organisation that represents, as its name suggests, all the key leagues in Europe, to take their case to UEFA to oppose the European Club Association's idea. And it is only an idea. It's not a formal proposal at this point. I think it's important to say that. But obviously we trust in them to make representations on our behalf. They've heard from clubs, they've heard from fans, they've heard from leagues, and now they've got to carry those messages forward and say, no, this is not what we want. You know, domestic football is very important to football fans all over the world, and particularly in Europe, where traditions are so long established. And we want to protect those traditions, and we want to do whatever we can to preserve what we all love. And that is playing football against our fellow countrymen each weekend of the season. European football is for midweek, and obviously our aspiration at some point in the future will be to play in those sort of competitions ourselves. The last thing we want is to have our potential access to those competitions limited by a format that really protects the biggest clubs and squeezes out the smaller to medium-sized clubs, and that really can't be good for football.
Okay. Well, we'll leave it there, Paul. Thanks very much for your time. Good luck over the summer. Enjoy the Jaeger ones with Martin. He likes a few of them, I hear.
As long as he's paying, that's fine by me.
That'll be a first, I think. But
it would indeed.
But again, thank you very much, Paul Barb, ladies and gentlemen. That was very interesting points there. Who knew? He's planning for a future in European competition for the Albion, which could actually, of course, happen this season if we'd have got to the final at Wembley. And we could have won the FA Cup, Al. It could have been amazing. But obviously, with that game against Manchester City coming up on Sunday, we also caught up with the Man City pod, the Blue Moon, and David Mooney from said show. David, obviously you're coming down to the Albion this weekend. It could be a big weekend or it could be a very bad weekend.
It could, couldn't it? There's only one or two ways this is going to go, isn't it? It's kind of all or nothing this weekend. And I think City fans are very, very aware of counting their chickens at this stage. And I only say that because back in 2012, you know, obviously, you know, United going to Sunderland, City at home to Queen's Park Rangers. Queen's Park Rangers needed a result to stay up, providing that, I think it was Stoke or Bolton, didn't get their result. And I think City fans woke up on that day and finally believed, oh, this is the day we're going to win the title. And then on 91 minutes, they're still 2-1 down. So I don't think that's going to happen this time. I don't think City fans will be going to the Amex thinking, "Oh, they're going to we're going to win the league today." I think it's going to be a lot more nervy than it was back then.
Yeah, I mean,
also with the fact that you kind of know Liverpool are going to get a result, so City have to get their own job done, and I'm not sure.
You see, this is the thing that gets to us a little bit. Like everyone just assumes that Liverpool are going to win. I mean, Wolves have beaten pretty much everyone in the top six this season, and they're not going there just to make up the numbers. They're going to have a say in this title race as well. I mean, I very much expect it to be 1-1 at the Amex and 1-1 at Anfield as well, which basically means you get the title.
Oh, you know what would be even better? It'd be an even bigger damp squib if we both lost, wouldn't it? That would be great.
Well, that's what football's all about. I mean, we saw this week, obviously, the result at Anfield on Tuesday night. I mean, what the hell was going on there? No one saw that coming in a million years. I mean, it was a 50-1 shot that they would actually pull that off, and they did. So maybe they've got their big news out of the way already for this week.
Fingers crossed. I mean, if Liverpool lose to Wolves, I don't care what you do to us. To be honest with you, I'm all for Brighton getting 3 points if Liverpool are guaranteed to drop them as well. So as long as at the end of the day, City are top of the table, I don't care how they do it at this stage. They've had such an extraordinary season. However it happens, it'll be the payoff that this season deserves, and in a strange way, I do kind of, as much as I've grown to hate Liverpool over the last 9 months or so, you kind of feel bad that one of us two does have to lose out in this league.
How has it come to this? I mean, the fact that both of you are going to be on 95 plus points at the end of the season and not win one of you is not going to win the title, that's never ever been heard of, and it will never be seen again.
It'll be one of us is going to get the third highest points total in the Premier League era and not win the title. That when you put it like that, it's ridiculous. I can only say it's just been two extraordinary teams this season. When Liverpool came to the Etihad in January, if City hadn't beaten them, if Liverpool had won that game, they'd have gone 10 points in front of City at that stage. And I was kind of looking at it thinking, you know what, if City aren't going to beat them, because obviously they'd drawn at Anfield earlier in the season, I kind of thought if City aren't going to beat them this season, they can't expect any other teams to go and do the business for them. So that's probably it for the title. I actually thought, to be honest with you, even though City did beat them and closed the gap to 4 points, I didn't really see it getting to the stage where going into the final day, City would be in the driving seat. But I mean, City have won, 13 in a row, 14 in a row since they lost at Newcastle. So, it's been an absolutely extraordinary performance. And I think from City fans' point of view, they were told all the way through last season that you can only really be called a great side when you've got back-to-back titles. And I feel that, you know, if Guardiola walks away from two seasons without back-to-back titles, but with 195 points or so, you kind of say that he's not built a great side. It kind of undermines the work he's done. I think City have been fantastic this season, but equally, I think Liverpool have been fantastic as well. So that's kind of why we're at where we're at.
Okay, so I mean, what have you made of the football under Guardiola? I mean, from a neutral's point of view, it's wonderful to watch, but it has been said that it's not the most exciting all the time, and it's like kind of like death by a thousand cuts to a certain degree.
I don't know if it's because I'm a massive nerd, but I find it fascinating the way City play. I can't really relax. I've not been relaxed in the last few weeks about the idea that
most City fans aren't, to be honest. Generally,
yeah.
I mean, you're still looking at the team sheet, expecting Sean Gota to be there, aren't you?
Well, that's true. But I mean, there's people from the outside always keep telling us, you need to relax because whatever happens, City get the job done and they find a way through. And the evidence is that yeah, they do. But I still think that, you know, maybe this week's the week where it doesn't happen because the other team are defending really well. I mean, take Leicester on Monday night. Leicester played really well. Mm. They didn't give City any space to work with. And, you know, the fact that Schmeichel had three saves to make in the entire game and he made two of them, and the other one was against a world-class strike that company's never going to do again in his career, let's be honest. To need a goal like that to win that game, it just says that, to be honest, it says how well Leicester defended and how well they played. And I think that, you know, week after week, you've got City putting in these performances where, you know, they always say if one doesn't get you, somebody else will. So if Aguero doesn't score, then Bernardo Silva will. Or if he doesn't, then, you know, David Silva will, or Sterling or Sane or whoever it is. But it's the way they move. Under Guardiola, I've never seen it. I knew he was good, but I've never realised just how good he was. He's got players moving in patterns where, I mean, as somebody who's watching, it doesn't matter which player is in those positions, they all make the same movement. So he's drilled them that well of where they need to run when this happens or this happens. And it's not just a simple case of when this happens, you go here. Because there's about 30, 40, 50, I don't know, 60 different scenarios that he's got kind of primed up for them. So no matter how hard you study them, they'll always find a way to go, oh, well, they're doing this to stop us, so when that happens, we do this instead. It's like watching a game of chess, but it's like Guardiola's playing, you know, three games in front because he's worked
out impressive.
What you're going to counter each one of his moves,
love it.
You know.
I love it. Now, obviously, this is going to be the third time we've played you this season. Obviously, the last one in the FA Cup semi-final where we basically tried to stop you playing. There's no two ways about it. And the early goal probably did hurt us. But we stayed in the game to the end. And again, at the Etihad, I mean, you did win 2-0. It was probably quite a comfortable game for you in the end. But we did frustrate you. Do you think that will happen again this weekend?
I think it'll be a frustrating afternoon for City fans again. I was going to say Brighton's on the beach, but you are literally.
We are quite literally on the beach.
Metaphorically be. But I don't kind of buy into that.
No.
Just because, I mean, it's your final home game of the season. You want to go out with a bang, don't you? So it's, I don't see there being any kind of instance of Brighton with the feet up and not putting in the performance. And Chris Hughton is a man who I genuinely really admire as a manager. I think he's done wonders with the clubs he's had.
Tell us more about that because I mean
they've been organised.
Tell us more about that because I mean he does get quite a hard press from certain quarters that he is. I mean we know what he's like. He is pragmatic, and I mean a lot of our support see him as being quite a negative manager, I guess. How do you see it?
I grew up in an era where City had to be quite pragmatic as well. So, I mean, I look at the Stuart Pearce era at City and it was awful. It was absolutely awful. I'd have killed for somebody like Chris who could organise a defence but know how to get a goal here and there. Pearce could organise a defence but had no clue how to get City to get anything out of the game. So I just think, you know, you look at his Norwich team, that was, I found that quite a good side to watch with the resources he had. I think with Brighton as well, you know, he's kept you guys in the Premier League two seasons running, and I'm fairly sure, correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm fairly sure when you came up, you were expected to be cannon fodder. I don't think
we were. I mean, we thought that with incremental progress is the way we look at it, and I think we, as a club, we have been geared up and trying to get to the Premier League for a while, and we were ready to get there and stay there. Now, obviously, this season we sleptwalked away into a little bit of trouble towards the end of the season. Some would argue that might be something to do with the FA Cup run. Some would say that, you know, trying to change the formation midway through the season has hurt us as well. But I mean, the Arsenal game on Sunday, it kind of saw us get our mojo back a little bit. I mean, we're playing. I mean, admittedly, we conceded a lot of chances, and Duncan Duffy were putting their bodies on the line like they always do. But we seem to be a little bit more progressive going forwards. We actually played with a lot more attacking intent, which we hadn't been doing over the last few weeks, even at Wembley to a certain degree against you lot then. So, I mean, I don't think we're going to leave ourselves too open on Sunday. But I'd like to think we would actually have a go as well.
Yeah, and I think you look at what happened at Wembley as well as a marker. For City fans came away from that game kind of going, well, City didn't play very well at all. And I think the reason for that was because Brighton didn't let them. And that, I think that could be another. It could be a tough watch this weekend if the same sort of thing happens. Knowing that you know, City probably need to get the win to win the title. And you know, when if it's 0-0 on 50, 60, 70 minutes again, the City fans will start getting a bit edgy and start getting a bit nervy, especially if news is filtering through from Anfield that Liverpool are doing the job. Obviously, if it's the other way, you know, City have had the, I don't know how much you know about City, but the 1996 relegation was the comical one with where they thought a draw was good enough to stay up, so they started time wasted by the corner flag and. All that did was waste their own time, and they still need another goal to stay in the Premier League, and that's what set them off on that lovely journey around the Football League through about 97 to 2001 ish. So I, in the era of smartphones and whatnot, that's not
bring back the transistor
time.
Radio. That's what we're saying. Okay, David, we're gonna have to leave it there. So I'd like to wish you good luck on Sunday, but we still actually want to get go out with a bang. We hope we make it really tense for you.
How good would it be for the title to be lifted at the Amex? Come on.
We've just been speaking to Paul Barber, and we've already said that we're giving you the bandstand to do that. So, you know, and that hasn't got a roof. It's like with Dean all over again. Anyway, thanks a lot. That was David Moody from the Blue Moon Pod, ladies and gentlemen. But that is all we've got time for. So thank you, of course, to Alan Wes. Thank you to Paul Barber. Thank you to David Mooney. This has been the Albion Raw. We'll be back with a regular show next week where we will be going through our review of the season, probably with the band. So we'll see you again next week. Thanks. Bye.
It's a wonder, Wonder Woman. You're so wild and wonderful. Whenever we're together, the planets all stand still. Barbarella, psychedella, there's a kind of cockle shell about you.
Barbarella, Barbarella.
Dazzle me with rainbow color, fade away the dollar shade of living. Get me up high, teach me to fly. Electrify my night with starry light above the stratosphere. Bring your dearness near till the dawn comes tumbling down.
Sound.
Every word we need comes from the skies. Can't you read my eyes saying love? Though you give me a cold shoulder, still I'm dying, girl, to hold you and make love. Psychedella, never can a fella name or claim you. Barbarella, 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 Barbarella.